and welcome to Recovery Machine. I'm your co-host, Nathan, joined by my co-host, Corey. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Nathan.
How's it going today?
It's good.
Right on. So this is our going to be our first part of two episodes that we're going to use to introduce each other. And from there, we'll talk a little bit more about what the podcast is going to be about. And we will occasionally be bringing in experts and or guests who know more about topics that we're interested in than we do.
Yeah, that's right.
So we'll get right to it. This is going to be Corey's introduction part. So we're going to just, I'm going to ask him some questions that we've kind of went over previously. And I think they're questions, we both think they're questions that will give you a kind of an overview of what it's like when a healthcare professional gets into trouble with substance abuse, and then what happens with getting back to work and all the politics and legal stuff that goes on with it.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So what is it that you do, Corey? What's your profession?
So I'm a registered nurse. I've been specifically an ER nurse for the last 9 years. Nursing for 12 years in total, though. I've worked in larger centers, tertiary trauma centers, and then some smaller sites as well.
Okay. So as an ER nurse, I think they have there's kind of a hierarchy of command there. And from what I understand, you were kind of the leader or team lead. Is that what they call it?
Yeah, that's right. So I was a coordinator and oversaw the multidisciplinary team and kind of worked as a liaison with physicians and kind of determined where people would go and navigate people through the ER during their stay and get them in, get them treated as quickly as possible, and then get them home.
Okay. So that's a lot of logistics, I guess. What kind of hours were you working when you were doing that in that position?
For the most part, I worked 12 hours. I would work 7 in the morning till 7 at night. Although occasionally I was known to work 16-hour shifts and stretch the day out.
Okay. Yeah, your nurses are pretty crazy with the with the hours. I couldn't. I'm a pharmacist. I can't imagine. I've done some 12-hour shifts, but 16, I think, would... 12 is too much, to be honest with you. 16 would be over the top. So what can you describe? I mean, how long has it been since you worked in this capacity?
I haven't worked in that capacity in about 14 months. So have been home during that time.
Okay. So thinking back to your last few shifts there, what can you give us kind of an idea of what you would do kind of throughout the day, and what your resources and support systems were like in there, as far as, you know, staffing was concerned and patient load and things like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, this was prior to going off work, this was during the pandemic, and it just as sort of things were maybe prior to the crescendo of the pandemic, but it was certainly building, and the staffing issues were growing on a regular basis. So it wasn't unusual that on the course of a shift, I would be doing my coordinator position, but also filling in any gaps within the staffing holes in the department. So that meant I often had a patient load or a partial patient load, and then would be relieving breaks and filling in any other gaps that went on as well.
Okay. So I'm imagining maybe you're talking to, you know, dozens of different staff members throughout the day, as well as dozens of different patients, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So, in the larger site that I worked in, we would see sometimes up to 150 patients a day. In the smaller site, it would be maybe 40 patients a day.
Okay.
And then managing a team of anywhere on a bad day from two or three nurses to, on a good, properly staffed day, maybe 5-6 nurses, and then again being the liaison with the physician team as well.
Okay. Yeah, I know right now, of course, across the province, probably the rest of Canada too, but BC is certainly having a big problem with staffing shortages with nurses particularly. So would you say, you know, you're saying the low mark would be two or three? How often, how many days out of a week would you say where you had full staff?
Maybe one.
One. Okay.
Maybe one.
Okay. So that's, I mean, I think if anything, maybe that's gotten a little worse now from COVID.
I think it has. And then, you know, and also there was an increasing regularity of relying on travel nurses, nurses that were passing through from out of province, picking up short contracts, and didn't necessarily know the community or know the department, but were expert at sort of learning as they went.
Yeah. That would, it's akin to a locum pharmacist or any locum healthcare professional, I guess.
That's right. Yeah.
With nursing, I think it might be a little different in that it's so, I would imagine it would be more imperative that somebody was part of the team and there on a regular basis. Especially if you're dealing with in the emergency, I suppose, you're down on the coast there where some of the hospitals are a lot bigger. In smaller centers in an ER, you're probably going to know a lot of the people who are in there. You know, you're going to have your regular kind of recurring people. And then other folks from the community, I guess, if it's smaller. But either way, it's probably helpful if you can have somebody who's been there and knows and fits in with the team.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a big difference. And knowing the community as well, knowing what's out there, what resources are out there for people, and helping patients navigate to get home safely or get to whatever facility they need to get to was a big part of it.
Okay. Cool. Kind of feels right now like for this interview so far, I feel like I'm a defense attorney. And I'm just going through I'm building towards a case of some sort. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing here. But anyway, bear with us, please. This is our first podcast.
Yeah.
So I guess if you could kind of put a number on your base stress level, I mean, every healthcare professional, I think, feels a certain amount of stress throughout the day. But it seems to be that nurses are maybe more taxed now than and recently than they have been in a long time. Like on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is your breaking point and you're leaving, you're throwing your scrubs down, you're walking out the door. What was your average, do you think, day-to-day stress level like in that position?
I think, you know, I couldn't say that it ever got below a 6.
Ooh, okay.
There would be lulls in the day or, you know, the day might start out okay. But could certainly get haywire really, really fast.
Okay.
And the nature of the job is that there are no rules about things happening one at a time. And so, you know, oftentimes when it rained, it poured. And it wasn't unusual for there to be a sequence of events or a sequence of crises that needed to be dealt with. And on days where there were staffing shortages and resource challenges, that meant it kind of fell back on those of us who were there. So the stress level could easily get up to a 9 or a 10 and be sustained like that for, 3 or 4 hours at a time. And maybe you'd have a little lull or you could catch your breath for a couple of minutes, but the baseline was a pretty high stress level.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about on par with what I've been hearing. So let's talk about the substance abuse issue. Could you give us kind of a, was there any particular scenario or was it a certain day where things had, was stress a factor that drove you towards what happened with the substance? And I'll leave it up to you to describe what the substance was and what and how it kind of developed into a pattern for you.
Yeah. So the substance of abuse for me was hydromorphone and opiates in general, but hydromorphone specifically. And in terms of how it sort of developed or or culminated up to the point. I certainly hadn't named the factors that led to it at the time. So everything I'm reflecting on is, of course, hindsight. And I wouldn't have called it anxiety at the time. I wouldn't have called it the result of trauma. And I wouldn't have called it the result of sort of my depletion of my mental reserves and my mental health. But at this point now, I can certainly reflect on those being huge factors in turning towards opiates. I had started to develop a feeling of anxiety at work, and wasn't unusual on my shifts to be, you know, again, in hindsight, have a feeling of stress in my chest, pressure in my chest, feel flushed, feel like my heart was racing. And I can't recall the first specific times that I took opiates at work. But I certainly remember knowing what how much it eased my feeling of stress and anxiety.
Right.
And I think I do recall that being aware at the time that the hook was almost instantaneous.
Okay. And a question, I asked this because I had my substance of choice was opiates as well, OxyContin and oxycodone to be specific. And the way the link, I think, for me was formed between that substance and the solace or the kind of sanctuary from stress that it provided. Yeah. I think that was formed long before I really put two and two together on a conscious level. And I wonder, did you have any, like, was there maybe an accident where you required surgery or some kind of pain situation where you had a prescription and you'd had some experience with it and there was an opportunity there to form that kind of a relationship? Or was this something that you were there and you're just like, you know what, I can't take it anymore. Let's see if this helps, that type of thing.
I was aware of opiates from in my personal life. As a teenager, I'd had a couple of dental surgeries, dental procedures that required me to have opiates. Mm-hmm. And I certainly remember the feeling. And then I remember, when I was about 15 or 16, taking them recreationally and on an empty stomach when I didn't need them, when I didn't have pain. And of course, that was when it was most pronounced to me that it created a euphoria, created a feeling of comfort and solace. And then it was years, obviously many years later, that I went back to that. But that was my first experience. It was probably, you know, almost 20 years before I ever came back to opiates.
Okay. Yeah, it's, I think, you know, I hadn't really considered this much before I really tried to start piecing together my own situation there. But I think for most people, there was probably some preliminary exposure to that where there was a little bit of a light that went on in their head, because opiates don't do that for everybody.
No.
And especially, you know, I think there's people out there who maybe only have that reaction with certain opiates, like, for example, maybe only Hydromorph gave him that euphoria, whereas codeine didn't, or, you know, just as an example.
Yeah. And that's right. Like I recall with codeine, and that's when I was in my teens, that was what I had tried, and that created actually a much more, irritable feeling.
Okay. And
a short temperedness. But I recall with, you know, the number of times I would give it to patients, give hydromorphone or opiates to patients, and seeing that effect on them, and having given it to patients, you know, tens of thousands of times, you know, at times as an ER nurse, you're giving dosing opiates, you know, 20, 30 times a day to different patients.
Right. So you're seeing that effect as well. You're seeing the peaceful glaze come over people's face and they calm down and maybe they go to sleep when they were very agitated before. So maybe that's a factor too. I didn't consider.
You know, and that's not to put blame on patients' pain requirements, but when you're constantly exposed to that and seeing that effect, and there's a sort of a reinforcement that it does calm people down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think these are all these type of motivators or drivers are important to at least discuss, because, you know, if you're somebody who's had a problem like this and you're considering getting back to work, these are issues that you may or may not want to ease back into, depending on the stability of your recovery.
Yeah, so that's right.
They're all important factors.
They are. And, you know, the thing that that I was just thinking about was that connection, and you mentioned that, Nathan, the connection between the stress and anxiety that you're feeling and the relief, those quite quickly became so entangled that the stress or anxiety would come on, and that was almost immediately linked with an urge.
So like a Pavlovian response.
It was. And, you know, I can give a truly Pavlovian example of that, not to fast forward too far, but in, you know, within the first week of coming off of opiates and detoxing, having such a feeling of anxiety, and, you know, the walls were caving in on my world, and had to face work, had to face my family and loved ones, and getting the taste. And there's a specific taste that occurs in your mouth. And for anyone who's experienced injectable opiates, it's a bitter, nasty, almost indescribable taste. And I remember being at home within a week of coming off of them, having an anxiety attack in my bedroom and thinking, oh my God, I can taste it. And you know, that to me was such a glaring example of the brain making that link between that feeling of stress, that feeling of anxiety, and the relief. And my brain was already telling me, cueing me towards the relief when it was unavailable, when I wasn't even in that setting anymore. So right. That was, you know, that's a striking sort of, again, kind of a Pavlovian example of that.
Yeah, that's amazing how the mind just demands when, you know, when you're in that situation. And so in that case where you don't have access to any more hydromorph, you're basically on a one-way street, heading straight towards anxiety attack, and you know, there's nothing for that other than to weather the storm or get more hydromorph.
You know, that's right. And when I was at work, it very quickly came to be that I wouldn't get to the point of an anxiety attack, but I would have this sort of low rumbling anxiety.
Right.
And in terms of mental cues, and I remember driving to work, and this was after some time of using opiates. And by the time I would be driving to work, I would start to develop a feeling of anxiety within my body. And then also that taste again. And I can remember the taste. I think I will go to my grave knowing what that taste is. And as I've learned skills, I no longer have that connection. If I have an anxiety attack, or if I'm feeling stressed, I don't taste it. But it's a strong memory for me.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting one to monitor. And I wonder, you're not back to work as a nurse right now, and I'm not 100% sure from talking to you if you are going to return. But I wonder, you know, with what research has shown as to the effects of your environment on those type of cues. You know, say you walk back into your ward right now, in, you know, just today, and just walk back in there. I wonder what would happen as far as, you know, would that taste just come right back just from being in that environment?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wonder that as well. And you know, have done some exposure therapy in term in my treatment, and it didn't initially. I never, because of the pandemic, I didn't get inside and go back into the department, but got pretty darn close with support, with, you know, with support and having learned some of the skills that I've learned. And so it didn't, but any kind of a hospital or clinical setting, it's such a sensory experience. There's the sounds of the alarms, the smell of the cleaner, the smell of body fluids, the smell of hand sanitizer, the sound of kind of the chaos and the bustle. And I think that very rapidly, the brain kind of enmeshes those sensory experiences with that feeling of stress and anxiety that you might have felt during traumatic situations, and then the relief and how to get you out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And from my experience, I believe that for the rest of my life, there will be a portion of my subconscious that is constantly working towards that end. So there's a part of me that doesn't care about long-term consequences or anything else, really. It just wants to get back to that drug. So if it can use an environment like that with all those cues to its advantage, then it will try to get you back in there fast. It will try to get you back in there when you're not prepared. Because it wants a higher percentage chance to get you back into your addiction, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So you started using Hydromorph at work, and this, of course, would turn into, maybe it started as a frequent or a semi-frequent thing or infrequent, and turned into, I imagine, a daily situation where you're physically addicted to it. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I only ever worked part-time, or at least within the last couple of years of being in the ER. I always had, you know, 3 or 4 days off, and wasn't bringing it home with me, because I was only sort of able to get what I could get to take there during those shifts. And so, you know, the question that I remember being asked by physicians about that, like about my experience with detox, and I really think it came to be that, particularly within the last couple of months, that I would come home from my days off and was experiencing some level of detox without even noticing it. And you know, and some of my sleep disturbance, some of my eating disturbances, my mood, I think those things were affected on my days off. But during my 2 or 3 shifts on, and if I picked on up overtime, going back into that environment with those cues, and despite my best efforts, and, you know, I've described this to you before, Nathan, that, you know, before my shifts, I would wake up in the morning, say, and be getting ready to go to work and get dressed and be looking at in the mirror and having a conversation with myself saying, that's not going to happen today. Today, I'm not going to be nabbing any hydromorphone. I'm not going to be using it. I'm going to get myself out of this. And within 5 minutes of going back into the setting, walking through those doors, hearing the sounds, smelling the smells, that sort of mass stimulation, and that cue would be right back there. And I would inevitably, you know, there initially, I think I was able to hold off for maybe a couple of hours or maybe an hour, but it came to be that it was minutes near the end there.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. And I haven't heard of a lot of people in my experience who were able to handle that drug that way. So it's pretty remarkable. I mean, you might have a kind of a unique set of genetics that allows you to do that. I don't think there's too many people out there who could manage a 3 day on and a 3 or 4 day off injectable Hydromorph situation. That's quite remarkable.
Yeah, but you know, again, in reflection, my consumption of alcohol was going up while I was at home, and my use of marijuana was going up while I was at home.
Sure. It also, I mean, when I hear that and I think, you're telling yourself you're going to go into work and not use, but you're basically probably, I mean, your skin is probably crawling by the time you're going back to your shift. I mean, you have no chance. Like you're,
I think so. And I didn't recognize that at the time, but I think it must have been. Again, that irritability that I was feeling and this sort of the emotional distress that I was in at times, I wouldn't have called it withdrawal. And I think my tools of denial were so well honed as well. And denial and just sort of ignoring it. Yeah.
Okay. So probably then in your mind, you figured that this wasn't a full-blown physical addiction. It was more of a psychological addiction, and that it would be something that would be easier for you to shake than maybe you thought if it was something that you were using all the time. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I had really chalked it up in my mind at the time to setting, and that once I eventually changed work settings, that would be the ticket and I would get out of that stimulation and not have that urge or desire.
Yeah, that's fairly classic kicking the can down the road type strategy.
Totally. But, you know, the piece that for me that, and I've described, you know, having balls, all these balls in the air, and that as long as you still feel like you're juggling, you can keep going. And for me, the schedule worked with my own personal life. I was a single dad. I had a mortgage to pay. I had these other commitments that I needed to, in my mind, felt like I needed to fulfill or else. And so I had this awareness that I needed to get out of there, that I needed to change settings, but I wasn't getting caught. I was able to get through my shifts. I was, for all intents and purposes, high functioning. And there was a reinforcement there, a reinforcement of it being something that worked.
Sorry, I just had a little bit of an audio issue there. Got it fixed. Yep. So that being said, you're finding that it was a effective strategy and that it was one that you had proved was somewhat sustainable. Could you tell us a little bit about, like what kind of, besides the, you know, toning down of the stress, what kind of benefits were you getting from using Hydromorph at work? Because I think a lot of people would expect that if you're a healthcare professional and you're using an opiate like that, it would be something that would be deleterious to your professional conduct, or, you know, maybe not something that would make you a better nurse, but something that would make you a worse nurse. Can you kind of speak to the advantages and disadvantages of that?
Yeah. You know, I, this is something I've thought a lot about, and, you know, I think at the time, given the stress and anxiety and depression that I was experiencing, I had this sort of a perfectionist quality, the super nurse quality that self-described, and also reinforced by the public, by the people I met, and by my coworkers, that Corey's coming on shift, he'll handle it. There's some slack that needs to be picked up. Give it to Corey. We're short-staffed. It's okay. Corey's working. He'll handle it. And so, simultaneously to that, I was feeling, you know, worse and worse about myself, struggling more and more with my mental health. And the opiate gave me the ability to kind of bring myself back up. It had quite a stimulant effect on me. It had a euphoric effect on me. And so it was not the image of, I was not the image that I think stereotypes and the media portrays of people out on the street, you know, hunched over. I was flying. I was flying, and I could go a mile a minute and be nice to people and be patient and go really, really fast.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, it's interesting that that's not as understood as you would expect. We've got the base stat before COVID was that 10% of all healthcare professionals at any given moment are using some kind of a substance to get through the day. Injectable hydromorph is, of course, a huge problem in BC with nurses. It's completely out of control, in my opinion. But it might not be that. It might be, you know, you're getting home and you find you've got to drink a certain amount of alcohol every night to, you know, sleep properly because of the stress throughout the day, all those types of things. What people don't realize is that if a lot of these drugs are used in such a way where they're titrated to a level that makes you, like you said, I'm speaking from experience here because I was the same way. We're very similar in this way in that for me, oxycodone was a stimulant, gave me more patience, empathy. I was able to be in situations where I would have had a hard time keeping my temper. And instead I was able to kind of talk my way through a situation that maybe I would have walked away from, that type of thing. That's kind of what you're describing. And can you know, how did your patients, was there complaints from your patients about, you walking around like a zombie or looking like you were groggy or anything like that? Or what was the feedback there?
You know, I had never received any negative feedback. I'd never received any complaint. But you know, within a month of going off work, and that's another story. But within a month of that, I recall getting a letter, an email from a physician who had received a letter of compliment about the care that I gave them, and what a nice, caring, thoughtful, sensitive nurse I was, who made them feel safe while they were there. And for me at the time, reading that email, I remember that, like, it gave me the sense of guilt and shame, but it also reinforced that all those balls were still in the air, that I was, right. It told me, not only am I functioning, but hey, you can keep going. This has brought you back to that level that I was at, you know, much earlier in my career, or even a couple of years ago before I had kind of become bogged down with stress and anxiety and that environment. So right. It told me, like, hey, you're okay.
Yeah. So maybe without that, that kind of assistance, pharmaceutical assistance, you might have been, rightfully so, heading towards a burnout situation. But because you had that hydromorph available, you were able to stave that off artificially and continue and not only do your job, but here you are getting reinforcing compliments from, staff and patients that you're doing an excellent job. So,
the burnout statement there, Nathan, is spot on, you know, and I think that actually occurred a long time ago.
Okay.
Or at least the need to pause and start to unpack some of the things that I was carrying around as a nurse, as an ER nurse. Life goes on, and the trauma and the stress keeps happening, and it won't let up, because you need it to let up. The shifts are the shifts. And so, you know, I think if I had paused a year prior, or even 6 months prior to starting to use, would have probably been preventable. But for a host of reasons, we keep going until we sort of can't go on anymore. But I think the burnout had happened some time ago. And the opiates, like I said, just kind of brought me back to that baseline, and then kind of brought me beyond that, where I could go even faster than I could before.
Right. And for longer. And
Exactly. And, you know, work 4 hours of overtime and still be keeping the same pace that I was at, hours prior in the shift. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you're able to kind of squeeze this extra energy out of your work life under the circumstances. How did it translate to things at home? Were there things at home that were bothering you other than the fact that you might have been in like a mild state of agitation from withdrawal? Or, you know, what was the downside of this strategy? Because it's that's what it was, right? A coping strategy.
Yeah, I think it was, I think it isolated me. I think I was isolating myself to keep the secret. I think I had a, was developing a more irritability, more difficulty with managing stress within my personal life. And I think that it, you know, the stress and the trauma that I was accumulating, in addition to hiding my opiate use, it put a barrier between myself and my loved ones. And suddenly I had a big secret, you know, and you do everything you can to kind of keep that secret, because there's, again, there's such a shame and such a stigma attached to opiate use that the act of hiding it becomes sort of as fundamental as using.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely felt the same way. In fact, you probably felt the amount of energy that was being drained on you daily just from keeping up that part of your juggling act, right? Like you need to make it so that everything's going okay. Plus you've got this thing, and you know, you've got the guilt and the shame in the background. And by the way, if you get caught, you're fucked, right? So you gotta, you know, you have to somehow protect that very carefully while you're going about your, you know, whatever your personal life is.
You do. And it really takes on a life of its own. The ability or the need to hide it, the need to manage all the aspects of your life, to preserve that secret, and to preserve that addiction is really, really compelling. And it's a silent voice that's telling you what to do, what not to do, guiding your actions without you even calling it by name. And of course, after the fact, I think we all learn to call it by name and call it what it is and out it. But at the time, it's very, very much a powerful force.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're not aware of it, I was blown away by what the subconscious is capable of and how far ahead it can be of your conscious mind.
That's right.
As far as you could find that your subconscious had made a plan days in advance that would put you in a vulnerable position. And you didn't realize until you got into that vulnerable position what your brain was trying to do.
Yeah.
But it was trying to get back or trying to get closer to getting more of that drug. And just because of that portion that I talked about earlier, that of your mind that is just hell bent on it. I guess once that link is formed, I mean, that's the way I look at it. You get that, yeah. Once that positive link is formed, it's a very difficult thing to, I mean, time is helpful, but I don't see it as something that's ever going to go away entirely for me.
No, anyway. No. And I really think that link forms remarkably quickly.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in that circumstance, and that new pathway, that new neural pathway of here's what I'm feeling, here's the effect it has on me, here's how I can manage it. And then it works and it reinforces it. And then the next time that stimuli, the stress, the anxiety come back to you, you've got your out. And it is like a magnet. And I can't speak to the pull that other substances have, but opiates are there's such a magnetic pull that is telling your brain, this is your out. You know this, Corey. You know that. Remember how shitty you were feeling yesterday on your shift? Remember all that anxiety? And remember how when you took that hydromorphone, the anxiety was gone and you were back to being super nurse? And the pathway is formed as quickly as that, I believe.
Yeah. And that's, you know, a lot of people when I talk to healthcare professionals who are in this position, one of the things they say early on is, I can't believe that I've done something so crazy.
Yeah.
And I looked at it the same way until I started to understand the way the mind works and the problem at its roots. And it's not one of irrationality, because the drug is actually an extremely reliable solution in the short term. All you have to do is take the drug and the problem goes away. There's nothing irrational about that. The problem is that you convince yourself that it's a long-term strategy. And that is not the way we work as a species. You cannot continue to hide your head in the sand. It just, over time, breaks you down and your resilience to stress becomes less and less and less. It's weakening you while you are believing that it's providing you strength. And it doesn't take very long before you're in too deep, and then you can't really do very much at all without it. You know? So it's interesting to look at it as a short-term solution, but an extremely poor long-term solution.
Of course. But you know, one thing I've learned about the sort of the mental effect of trauma is that long-term, it kind of ceases to exist in a way.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And it all becomes about the short term.
Yeah.
And looking ahead, I mean, yeah, in hindsight, I sure wish I could have looked ahead and looked, you know, a couple of weeks or a couple of months down the road. But I was looking just within that hour. I just got to get through this next hour, because, you know, I know it's going to be this busy. I know this is going to happen, or I can anticipate that this is going to happen. Got to get through that. And again, it's happening in a voice that's not necessarily your own voice, but it is a very, very compelling one.
Absolutely. And this is one portion of it. I'm not a big fan of calling any kind of substance use disorder is technically the term, but disease is the word that a lot of people like to use in recovery. I don't think it's a disease. I think of it as there's a book called Disorder of Choice, and I believe the author's last name is Heyman. But at any rate, that one resonated with me because there is, of course, something going on in your limbic system, and it's that short-term hijacking where it's front-loading everything in your brain to be much more enticed by the short-term and solution, as opposed to looking down the road and thinking, well, you know, this is not going to work out in the end. You stop thinking as much about long-term solutions. Yeah. And that's a fact. We can see that with, you know, it pans out in the evidence and the studies that they've done, that actually is happening. But of course it's a reversible in most cases. You know, as long as you stop using the drug for X amount of time and work on finding better ways and healthier ways to manage stress, then eventually your limbic system comes back and you're once again a more balanced person who's able to think in long-term solutions.
That's right. And you know, I considered on a regular basis all of the things that I had to lose, you know, including, you know, my job, my home, my son, people's opinion of me, people's trust in me. I was very much aware that I was jeopardizing that, but that was secondary, and not only secondary, but it was constantly being sort of challenged by that short term,
right?
And the short term that says, here's how we get through those negative thoughts too, because dwelling on those negative thoughts and dwelling on the fear of losing everything would then produce that same, that same stimuli, that same anxiety that got me there in the first place. Yeah. So it's a loop that for me had to be cut off, and had to be cut off by getting me out of those situations that brought me that stress and anxiety, and then doing a full reset.
Right. Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about what led to you being able to do that? What circumstances at work or personally led to you coming to the realization that this was not a successful long-term strategy and that you needed to do something?
So, you know, I can't take credit, full credit for coming to that myself, but I had been called by my employer and told that I wasn't to come in for my following shifts because there was an issue that they needed to discuss with me. And I knew immediately what that issue was. To me, there was no, oh, well, could it have been this? Did I make a mistake? I knew right away. And the feeling of real.
What did that feel like? I'm just curious because that is probably a feeling that not too many people are familiar with.
You know, it was simultaneously terrifying and anxiety producing and the greatest feeling of relief I've ever experienced in my life. Truly. And I remember being in my truck about to go out, go to the store, and I'd got this phone call. And I remember thinking, shit. And then thinking, oh my God, I am out of this.
Yeah.
I don't have to do this charade for another hour of another day. And the relief was just monumental relief.
Yeah. That's something that I don't think people would appreciate unless they heard it from somebody from that circumstance, because I mean, to be under that, you know, most people would be, oh my God, that must have scared, you know, just a terrible feeling, right? Like, yeah. Here comes the, you know, this is going to be a horrible series of events, but I can totally relate to what you're saying too. It's the energy required to continue that strategy. The mental effort is you can't describe how difficult it is to keep, like you said, all those balls in the air. Very difficult.
Very difficult. And I think that, to me, that fact that I felt that sense of relief tells me that I wasn't totally gone. You know, that there was a shred of my true nature that was still very much left intact, in that, you know, what I thought was, I can get back to being who I really am. I could get back to my family, get back to my son. And now, that's not to say that I never had anxiety throughout this process, because the next day I know that I did. But that initial feeling was, I'm out of this.
Yeah.
No matter what, I'm out of this. And I think I was really working myself towards a crisis. I knew that. I knew that based on sort of how my last couple weeks of shifts had gone. And so to be out of it meant that I could maybe start to get my life back. So after I was called and told that I wasn't to be coming into work until I met with them, I took it upon myself to kind of get that ball rolling. And called my union, called the legal side of my union, and reported myself to my union. And you know, things took off initially quite quickly from there. And I had, you know, that was on a Wednesday or Thursday that all of that happened. So, you know, and just on a couple of interesting sort of personal anecdotes about that time was that I was, you know, we had just had this massive fall storm. And it had knocked a part of my fence down. And so my backyard was entirely exposed to the neighbors. And, you know, I think that was kind of symbolic of what was about to happen to me. And ironically, it was my family who came over and helped me put this fence back together. And all the while I had this secret, I knew that I needed to tell them that I was going to have to go off work and that I was addicted to opiates. But what I was trying to get through was my son's birthday. And I had already committed to hosting my son's second birthday. So in my mind, I thought, well, this was like a Thursday or Friday, get through to Monday. And wasn't sleeping, was planning this children's birthday party, feeling again, by that time, you know, my anxiety and that initial relief had kind of faded, and it was more the feeling of the walls crashing in on me. But got through this party, through for all intents and purposes, a normal birthday party. And then, you know, the Monday after the party, went over to my parents' house and talked to them.
So did this all take place, you contacting the union and talking to your parents before you had confirmation that that's what work wanted to talk to you about?
I never had confirmation.
Okay.
Until my first meeting with them.
Okay. They really dragged that out, eh?
They really dragged that out. And I wasn't told, here's what we want to meet with you about. I just knew. And I knew that I knew myself well enough to know that my practice was pretty clean you know, it might sound confusing to a listener to say that, you know, that I knew that my practice was clean and that I, you know, that I was a by the book nurse, otherwise, apart from the fact that I was using opiates. But I think that can be so that you know, someone can be an expert and be a perfectionist in many other ways, but just have that substance use issue that kind of keeps them afloat for a period of time.
Yeah, well, certainly it's something I've seen with healthcare professionals who get into this position, and it's almost ubiquitous that there's some level of perfectionism there.
Yeah.
I am a firm believer that that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
It's holding yourself to a higher standard than maybe is even realistic that drives you down a path of desperation. You know, there's all sorts of different facets here, but I definitely believe that that's one of them. And people, it's something that people need to understand, is that just because you're using drugs doesn't mean that it's going to be something that's apparent, or even, you know, it might not even be something that causes outright issues with the way that you're practicing your profession, but it will eventually.
Yeah.
And, in some way, shape, or form.
The thing that came to mind for me was that some of the best nurses that I've ever met, some of the really elite, high quality nurses, smoke. And that the nurses who go the fastest, work the hardest, are like type A, relentless, just ball busting nurses. Yeah. And they're heavy smokers.
Yeah.
And of course, there's stigma there, and there's criticism, public criticism there, and all the rest, but it is still, you know, obviously much more socially acceptable and is, you know, obviously a highly addictive behavior.
It's the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. Whether one is legal, one is not, one is socially acceptable, one is not, one is shocking to some people, one is not, it's the same strategy for the same problem, and the results ultimately are the same.
That's right.
Shortened lifespan, all sorts of health issues.
That's a good point. I had taken the initiative and made the call to my union and gone through the legal department of my union, and from there it was quite a waiting game, and I had simultaneously gone off of you know, called in for the remainder of the month of my shifts, as advised by the union, and then made a claim with WorkSafe, and knowing that I would, you know, kind of suddenly having the realization of how unwell I was, realizing that this was a issue of addiction, but also an issue of coping with stress and anxiety and trauma. And so went that route as well. And then it was kind of the waiting game from there until the system kind of caught up to be ready to put me through the machine, so to speak.
Right. Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about what that meeting looked like when you were first confronted by your employers?
That was just a phone call. There was no meeting. It was just a phone call. And saying that I had to have this meeting. Yep. And because I was advised to go off work, to call in sick and go through this process of seeking treatment, that meeting was paused for many, many, many months.
Oh, months. Months. Okay. So there was no confirmation. So I guess they must have just assumed, or maybe there was some collaboration behind the closed doors where there shouldn't have been, about what the nature of the problem was. Whatever the case may be, they decided that they wanted to really think about it before they brought you in for a face-to-face meeting.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was that? So you've had all these months. Now, what were you doing in that time while you were waiting?
So, I mean, for the initial couple of months, and again, I was, you know, off work and kind of waiting for various appointments. Went off work in October, had the IME in, at the beginning of December. Within November.
So an IME is a initial
medical exam. Yep. In this case, with an addictions doctor. Okay. Who is a third party who does a extensive sort of history taking and kind of makes the determination about the addiction and provides the diagnosis of a substance use disorder.
Okay. So you had that done, you had your IME done even before you had talked to your employers in person then?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And what did that doctor determine when you basically went in there, and I'm assuming you kind of laid your cards on the table. Is that fair to say?
You know, I did. Yeah. I had sort of decided early on to this in this that I would try to be as graceful as possible, via being honest and by being forthright about what was going on with me. So I was very frank with the physician about the nature of my addictive behavior and what I was doing at work and how often I was using Hydromorph. And you know, that we went far back into my history about, you know, they took a full history about mental health and substance use, family history, family history of addiction, family history of mental health, everything. You know, by the end of the 2-hour appointment, she knew sort of the inner workings of myself and my family.
Okay. So was there kind of a diagnosis at the end, something on paper that put a title to your problem, or what was that like?
Yeah. So by the end of it, I had been diagnosed with opiate use disorder. I think she referred to it as mild or moderate.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I don't know, I don't, to be honest, sort of know the spectrum of that there, what it would have taken to be more severe in terms of the, sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
If anyone's interested, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual number 5 is the one that physicians are encouraged to use in British Columbia to make these type of diagnoses. So you would, they would just, I mean, anyone can look in there. You can see what needs to be checked off. And if you check enough of the boxes, you'll be severe. If you check a couple, you're considered mild to moderate. And
yeah.
So that's where you were at with it. And what did the physician say what did they recommend for treatment?
So I had to wait, and, you know, and this was one of the most agonizing parts for me was the wait of finding out what the diagnosis was and what the plan of treatment was. I had a addiction specialist who was quite collaborative with me and willing to allow me to participate in the discussion about treatment. And my biggest concern, my only concern, was what was going to happen. You know, would I have to go away? Would I have to leave my son for a period of time, months? And for me, that was a big line in the sand that I wasn't going to see myself, you know, going away from my son for anywhere from 1 to 3 months. Right. So And she heard that. And I, you know, to this day, I'm really grateful for that. And I don't know, fortunately, I didn't have to find out what my personal reaction to that would have been. But she heard my concern about that. And so she suggested that I was would qualify and be a good candidate for a home-based rehab program.
Right.
Or at least outpatient rehab program, rather.
I just want to give props to that addiction specialist, because that would be, from what I've seen in my experience with this type of thing, that would be an exception to the general rubber stamp, which is what you usually get. As soon as you check off enough of those boxes, there's no more talk. There's no more consideration of your life circumstances. You're generally sent away.
Yeah.
Whoever that is, thank you.
Yeah, same for me. I mean, that to me was a life-changing decision. Given that I had sort of made this personal decision within myself that I hadn't vocalized that, you know, I'm just not going to do it. For her to agree that I had enough agency and enough support at home, that this would be an effective course of action, was for me to enter an outpatient program. Yeah, that was a game changer, a life changer.
Okay.
And so it was recommended that I enter an outpatient program. Given that this was at the peak now of the pandemic, this was all via Zoom. And so I was able to do a 6-week program, sitting on my computer in my kitchen.
And, well, aren't you the luckiest guy in the world?
You know, I say it on a regular basis. I really am. I really am. And I know that that's not the most common experience by any means.
No.
Yeah, for me, that's how it unfolded.
And judging by where you are now, you must have found some benefit in that program, I guess.
I did. You know, it worked really well for me. I got to say too, while we're giving out props, I did that program in combination with my own therapy and with my own therapist. And so
okay.
I had days where I was, attending a 6 to 8 hour session of outpatient rehab on Zoom, would have my routine with my son afterwards, and then have an hour counseling session, and tried to use that as sort of time to consolidate.
Okay.
I was going to say at the very beginning, one of the first phone calls that I made, going back to when my employer first called me, was to my previous therapist. And I had seen her, a couple of years prior for going through a divorce and separation, and called her back again. And she was very willing to have me and to support me. And one of the first things that she had said to me, like on the first day that I went back to her, was, "Are you ready to turn over every single stone this time and get your hands dirty and dig into yourself fully? Because this is your freebie. You know, you came out of a serious opiate addiction alive, and with your home and with your kid, etc. And now, let's dig into this for real." So I used that along with the rehab program that I was put into, and the two just it was they were both there was a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy in it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of sort of digging into history and trauma and life circumstances, and then developing some fundamental strategies for coping and for changing my thoughts and my negative thinking. And so it all kind of worked really well together for me.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that's all it has to do. Some people, depending on how much choice they have and where they're going, as far as treatment centers are concerned, find themselves in a situation where they're getting very little out of the center, wherever they're sent. Some of them are better than others. We'll say that. And, so, I mean, if you were able to, you're able to do that at home and then also have a therapist that was working with you and have that kind of collaboration and make it work. That's pretty special. I don't think there's too many opportunities like that out there.
You know, it was, and I'm a pretty creative minded person. And so in addition to the structure of the rehab program, the other thing that I was doing with my own therapist was art therapy.
Oh yeah.
And so within the first, I was going to say months, but it was within the first weeks of being home and being off work, diving into art projects that helped me kind of release the trauma and the all of the ugly stuff from work that was accumulating in my head. So the release from that kind of made space to bring in all of the new information with rehab. And
I see.
It was a really, really helpful combination for me.
That's excellent. So you've been off for 14 months, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. So is that the same as the last time you've used Hydromorph would have been around that time?
That's the last time I used any substances or alcohol whatsoever was 14 months ago. Yeah.
Any kind of substance. Okay. All right. And I guess, just to kind of, it's always interesting to have a marker, and I know everybody's different this way, but what was, how long was it, would you say, before you kind of started to feel like maybe you were normal Corey again?
I think
or are you there yet?
I think I am. Yeah. I think 2 months was the initial kind of wave.
Okay.
Of starting to feel normal. Now the bias in that was that it was also Christmas time. So there was, a lot of good feeling, a lot of positivity, a lot of gratitude, and was starting to kind of come to developing some emotional bounce back, some true sort of feeling of my emotions again. But then I would say by 90 days, that was when I had sort of had that real emotional awakening, where like laughter was coming back, tears were coming back, things that I hadn't experienced in a really long time.
Yeah. And, that's 90 days. It seems to be the magic. It's a special marker for some reason. And it's even if, regardless on your substance abuse issues and your history with substance abuse, if you can get, even if you don't have a problem with substances, you're an occasional drinker, occasionally, maybe you're into cannabis, whatever. But taking a 90-day break from all those substances, is there's something about that actually clears the mind in a different way. I know a lot of people do like Sober October and stuff like that, but the 90-day mark, there's a little bit of science behind that too. I think it's something to do with your neurotransmitter turnover and the way the limbic system kind of restores balance. But it's interesting that you mentioned that as a clear mark.
It was distinct, it really felt like a switch to me, in that I was laughing at things again, laughing at movies, hearing music that I'd heard before, maybe that would have kind of fallen flat, that sounded more alive, that sort of elicited, more of a response within my body. I remember sort of within that time period feeling like, feeling like Ebenezer Scrooge when he woke up on Christmas morning and, was giddy, scaring the shit out of everyone dancing down the stairs. And I think for my family and for the people around me, they were kind of recognizing that I was kind of becoming that person again, that was alive and laughing, having fun again.
There's something because of the way opiates, the blanket that they cover you with and the blanket that makes you comfortable also keeps out all the it keeps out all the music, and it keeps out all a lot of like things are funny, but not really funny, you know, like nothing is really getting through to you like it normally would. You're not sensitive to that kind of emotional stimulation, I guess. I can.
Yeah. And, you know, and trauma sort of does the same thing. I've come to realize that constant sort of stimulation of trauma blunts some of those edges, and being exposed to experiencing other people's trauma, being a part of the trauma where you're seeing it, smelling it, feeling it, being sensitive, taking it on. There's a desensitization that happens there.
Okay. And so that was something that maybe you were feeling even before from work, like
anyone who's entered an ER or I think of soldiers for that matter, and that stereotype of like the tough, grizzled veteran nurse or grizzled veteran soldier, and there's a toughness there, there's a thick skinnedness, and that may, I've come to believe, may be part of the result of exposure, that it's not just, you know, that they're jaded, but that they're the edges of their highs and their lows and their edges of their response to fear and their response to stress are so rounded off that you get this kind of blunted outlook and blunted sort of style of receiving information and behaving.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and then you add, but the internal anxiety, the internal stress is still there. So throwing opiates into that mix, which you described it perfectly as sort of that blanket, now those edges are really, really dull, really blunted. And I think seeing sort of that sort of emotional, any kind of emotional vulnerability or authenticity becomes more and more difficult to see.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of a time where I had detoxed myself I was on a really, I was out of control with the oxycodone for sure, but I decided to do a detox by myself, and that did work for some time, but I hadn't fully dealt with the issues. So inevitably I relapsed. But during that first kind of taking the blanket off and then walking back out into the world, I remember visiting my sister in Cumberland on the island, and all of a sudden my vision kind of came back, and I was like, what the? And I started looking around at the trees, and I went up and I grabbed a leaf and I was looking at it, and the colors were all vibrant, and I'd forgotten what things looked like because I'd been under such a heavy haze all the time. You're not paying attention really to any of that stuff. None of it matters. You're just kind of in your own little bubble, right? And you're comforted in your own little bubble. But once that shield comes off, you're at first is of course terrible, but then when your senses start to come back, it's pretty amazing.
It is. And I, you know, I think there's, it lends itself to the spiritual experience that so many people have in recovery.
Yeah. Maybe
you know, I can't help but think of that. It's quite common for people to turn to religion or turn to that connection to a higher power. And part of that, I think there must be an affiliation there with the awakening of the senses.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then
absolutely.
Learning about gratitude but literally the awakening of the senses is a extremely acute and powerful thing.
Yeah. Because it's so much more so than it's a pendulum, right? Yeah. You've got the pendulum all the way cranked. And once you let that pendulum swing, it's not just that you're experiencing things like other people. You're experiencing things on a much more acute and intense level for a little while that's that right. Pendulum's in the other direction. Eventually it settles down, but for a while, you're absolutely right. It is almost like that experience I was speaking about with the leaves, that was almost like a psychogenic experience, you know, in that, in the way that my vision had just all of a sudden switched, you know. And I'm sure there's some sort of physiological reason for why that happened in my brain, but it's, yeah, I mean, of course, lots of people would look at that and think, holy, this is it.
Yeah, you know, it's so vivid. I remember, again, right around Christmas time, so about 60 days into sobriety, and watching a thriller movie, and it pushed so many buttons in me and generated such a feeling of fear in me and an anxiety in me. And I've watched, you know, during all of my years as a nurse, could watch, you know, a horror movie or a thriller or whatever and be unfazed by it. Mm-hmm. But suddenly I watched this thing my brain was making connections to things that I experienced at work. And the intensity of that was just enormous, so much so that I had to, you know, go home and go to my therapist about it and talk about it, and ended up creating a painting about it. Oh, wow. And again, those are gifts, you know, that those are, you know, I think what many would call gifts of sobriety, that those senses and those feelings come back, including sadness, including negativity and fear and feeling all those things again for the first time in a very authentic way.
Yeah. You mentioned sadness. I can remember, I was maybe a couple months off and still, you know, even your skin is, you touch your skin and it's, you know, everything is very tactile, and your emotions swing wildly too. And I remember just, I was sitting there, I think I was watching a hockey game and a commercial came on, and I just got like, I got choked up. It's just a stupid car commercial or something. I'm like, what in the hell is the matter with me? But that's, again, that, you know, return of all those neuro, and your, I mean, of course, your endocrine system, your hormones, all that type of stuff is affected by opiates as well. So it's no surprise, but yeah, it's interesting going from completely blunted to all of a sudden, you know, getting choked up by a commercial.
Yeah.
So I guess we should tell people that I met Corey through a support group that we both attend. It's basically for healthcare professionals, and it's something I've been involved in for a while. So I've got to see a few different aspects of what the process looks like as far as what kind of environments, what kind of workplace stresses set people up, what kind of personalities set people up for this type of problem in the first place. And then what works as far as bringing people back and making connections and important connections with people who understand the problem. So that's, if anyone's wondering, that's kind of how me and Corey met each other. And we have similar viewpoints and I think similar stories. And the idea of this podcast is to use our experiences and what we've learned about addiction and recovery to try to help people. And the earlier we can help, the better when it comes to healthcare professionals with this particular problem. So we'll do an introductory episode reversed. Corey's going to interview me.
Yep.
And then we are going to continue on with looking at the current state of recovery, how what we're calling the machine, because it's a very regimented, protocol-heavy scenario as far as treatment is concerned in BC right now. So we're going to be looking at the machine every episode, and then we're going to relate something that we've discussed within that machine to a particular recovery point that we think is going to be helpful for people. So yeah, if that's something that interests everybody, then we will keep going. And at the very least, I think there's probably a few people out there right now who are, you know, in that pre-contemplative stage. And if there is people out there who can get this kind of a message and get this kind of information faster, it's going to help them, because it can be a devastatingly difficult road back. So that's why we're doing this. And I guess that you're in the spot now, Corey, where you've been through treatment. You've got ongoing. Are you still working with your therapist?
A different therapist now, but I still have a therapist that I see twice a month.
Okay.
And attend Smart Recovery meetings 3 times a week. Okay. I'm now helping with co-hosting, and then the meetings that I attend with you weekly.
Okay. So other than that, can you tell us a little bit about where you are now, what you're, how you're feeling, what the future looks like, and what you're hoping happens with your employer, that type of thing?
Yeah. So I'm still at the stage where I'm waiting to return to work. I have not returned to work yet. And frankly, I don't know what that will look like yet, but what I have ultimately learned, and I'll try to just sort of tie it together, is that my journey of recovery is so much bigger than that. And the things that I've gotten back in the process of recovering and experiencing sobriety has changed my life. I think that I was I needed to completely fall flat in order to rebuild myself and in order to fully heal. And you know, I think that includes a long period of time before substance use occurred. So I'm at a point now where I have a really different outlook on my life, where I've been able to rid myself of some of the shame and anxiety and depression that I was experiencing leading up to addiction and during the early stages of recovery. So I'm at a point where of a turning point in my life and a new beginning, I think. And the relationships in my life have strengthened. The connections have strengthened. I think trust is a process, but I think I've gone a long way in rebuilding trust there, with my family and close friends. So those are the most concrete examples of where I'm at. And where I'm at with work is kind of patiently waiting and doing what I can on my own to make sure that I'm as mentally fit and strong when I do return. And also realizing that my recovery is so much bigger than my return to work will be.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
That at the end, and that took me a long time to get there. That took me over a year to get to that. And I was mulling that over for the last year, and there's been a lot of internal conflict around that. But at this day, you know, this week, I can really say that my journey of recovery is bigger than my return to work. And if, you know, in terms of take homes that I hope for the listener, that would certainly be one of them, is that the journey of recovery is bigger than your employment and all of the other stuff.
That's an easy one to hear and a difficult one to understand. Yeah. Early on, it's exactly the opposite, right?
You know, exactly the opposite.
What's the holdup? Let's get back to work. What do you mean? Recovery? What the hell are you talking about? But
yeah, you know, I met a man once who told me, in terms of his addiction, he said it took me a long time to join this club.
Right.
You know, and I include myself in that. It was a long time leading up to that. There was the big crash down, and I'm in, you know, still in the rebuilding stage, and giving myself permission to have time with that and to take time and to genuinely, authentically see where it goes.
Oh, that sounds awesome, man.
Yeah.
I'm happy that things have worked out the way they have for you. And I'm excited about continuing on with this little project here, and hopefully we can produce some content that somebody finds useful.
I hope so. For the person going through in the middle of the journey, and for the person who hasn't fully entered that machine yet and who doesn't even know that they're kind of on the cusp of that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's many out there right now.
Yeah.
So, okay. I think we'll call it there for your portion of the interview. Does that sound like a good spot?
Sounds like a plan. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. And then, so next time we'll do the same thing in reverse and you can interview me and then the listeners will have a chance to kind of understand where both of us are coming from. And after that, we're going to start firing out more episodes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So we'll end it there and hopefully we'll be here next time for everybody.
Yeah. Sounds good, okay. Nathan. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.